This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. So, you think you want to write a memoir? What could be more innocent? You carry out a bit of research, rock up to the Mitchell Library, ask a few questions of your family members. Why, it's virtually an Australian pastime. This is exactly what Therese Warfield thought. And, beautifully groomed, donning her corporate suits, she thought she might explore her creative side. Instead, that process became a thin taper that lit a very large creative fire. Using a whole tank of passion as lighting fluid, Therese casts into relief the inner workings of an Australian regional country town. Expect the sticky, sweaty scenery, the slide of cutting words as someone walks by. And the story is brimming with vivid characters, hypnotic landscapes, and it's thick with realistic conversations. And replete, of course, with gender, class, and race issues. Not the big moments, but the little death by a thousand cuts of the way people look at you, the tone of voice they use, the slights they give. Therese picks them up, throws them onto the fire, more tinder. Suddenly, a memoir isn't a memoir anymore, but a full-blown novel. Her critiquer is Sajid Akan, a human resources specialist and a mother who grew up as an Australian Sikh in a country town herself. Sajid, with keen acuity, gives stunning insights about Therese's ability to describe being an outcast, of the importance of creating a shell, and speaks to the yearning for a sense of belonging, which lies at the heart of all such dynamic. Watch out for Therese's own piercing howl for freedom. This book she is writing is full of howls, of protest, joy, disdain. This is a writer's version of protesting in the streets, but there is no safe distancing and there are no hygiene protocols. Beneath those gel-polished, highly manicured nails are scrapes of skin and dirt. Oh yes, she draws blood. So sit back and enjoy this interview with two fascinating women who touch on topics that at this very moment in time are so important to us all. Hello, Therese, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Maria, and hi to all your listeners.
I know that your usual occupation, to somebody who's worked on royal commissions and high-level boards, you're writing a full-on novel.
I am. For about 30 years, I've worked in the corporate world, and I always had an interest in creativity and was always trying new things like painting and sketching.
Does that mean that you were grasping for something creative to
do? I was. I came across a book by Julia Cameron called The Artist's Way. One of the things that Julia recommended was journaling daily. I really enjoyed writing, and the more I wrote, the more I seemed to have a wellwith inside of me. Mm. I decided to do a couple of creative writing courses. There was one course on memoir writing. So I thought, all right, well, I'll write my memoir, starting from when I was a child, living in a small country town in central west New South Wales. I started researching in the Mitchell Library. It started my imagination work.
But was that a surprise to you to do that research? Because you're starting off with like wanting to creatively express yourself, trying to find the right medium, finding writing and enjoying it, and then doing some research that triggers off, I think, a lot of memoirists out there would relate to that. Were there surprising elements of that?
There was a very surprising element. My mother attended my uncle's funeral. A couple of people came up to us and they introduced themselves as being relatives. It turned out that my mother had a secret half-brother who was fathered by my maternal grandfather, and the woman that he was with was an Indigenous lady, which meant that my mother had a half-brother. But unfortunately, this Indigenous man and his mother had both passed. It was a very sad moment because my mother never knew she had another brother. Yeah. It was bittersweet, and Mum took it quite badly, actually, and she was very upset that nobody had told her.
Yes.
And she tried to find information about the man and his mother and kept hitting brick walls. But I never forgot.
One of the things that really struck me about hearing your novel as you were writing it, the level of detail is so rich. The descriptions of all the people, and yet the central character is someone that you've never met.
That's right.
And is a family member. I don't know, was that something that surprised you, that the story started to centre around that?
It surprised me that I had such strong memories.
If I can use you as an example of somebody who seems to have a character spring up in front of them.
Yes.
It doesn't matter where the inspiration comes to, you know, there's almost like this thin vapour that happens between you and your character, so you can almost feel what they're feeling, and that's the way that you can describe them.
Yeah.
Elements of racism, like they're not the common exposition of racism.
Yes.
They're more like showing how it is that people are reacting to each other at that much more subtle level.
Yes.
That's so beautifully crafted and
thank
drawn.
You, Maria.
Yeah.
I've always been very observant of people. Mm. I grew up around adults, and I was the child that sat in the corner and listened and watched.
Well, you did that to good purpose.
I didn't have a happy childhood.
Yeah.
I didn't feel as if I belonged either. So there is an element of my own feelings of being left out or overlooked in my main protagonist, which is Jay, the young Indigenous boy. So there are elements of me in him.
But I want to ask you this as a craftsperson. So you started to journal, you were starting to write, and then all of a sudden you hit this rich vein of material that inspires you. Did your writing change once you'd hit that motherlode kind of thing?
The first time I ever attended a writing group, a group of people that were actually serious about their writing, I read out a piece of my work and I was so nervous, my hands were shaking so much that I had to sit on them with my paper on my knees and just read. I was just so overwhelmed by the whole experience and I got so much wonderful feedback and I felt so good about overcoming my fear of letting anyone hear my work that it just inspired me. And I also found that my writing improved. My writing today is so much different than it was even 12 months ago.
Right.
I can see where things are working and where they're not. I get a lot of enjoyment out of that as well. It's not about even publishing a book. I don't even think that far ahead.
Yes.
I really don't. I see my characters in my head. I see them. I smell them. They're so vivid. I can see everything about them. Everything.
Well, with the other interviewees I've had so far, we talk about the rolling out of a plot and everyone's got their different way of doing it. With you, the story is quite tense.
Yes, it is.
You know, there is crime involved and there are all sorts of clashes between people. How does that plot unroll for you? Is it something you plan or is it just happening as you're sitting there with the characters?
Well, it was just unfolding when I first started writing, but I wrote a synopsis not that long ago and I went through each chapter that I planned to write and I had like two or three lines on what I wanted to have happen in the chapter. So that gave me a greater understanding of where I was heading.
Yes. Did that help you to write that little precis of each?
It did, yes, because I wasn't really sure where it was heading. Yeah. But once I had it down on paper, I thought, yes, that's it, I've got it.
Another question I want to ask you, like you were in a quite stressful job.
I would
have thought, you know, the corporate world and at the level at which you were working would have provided you with lots of material of nefarious and noble behaviour on both ends of the scale. How did you fit it all in? Like, how do you shape your life around a project that is getting momentum?
I found it extremely difficult. Used to get exhausted by the end of the day and anxiety that I was under in my job. It was a very stressful job. So I found it very difficult to find the time to write. I ended up falling ill. So for the last 6 months, I haven't worked and had a lot more time to write, a lot more time to think about the plot and to work on it.
So the role of writing in your life, how would you describe it?
I would say that if I was a wolf, I would howl for my pack and my pack would answer as writers, as character creators.
Yeah,
that is the thing in my life that I'm the most passionate about.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me feel alive.
Yes.
It is really feeling like I've finally come home. And the fact that people gave me so much good feedback and was so encouraging, that really made all the difference to me.
Look, it wasn't a kind group. They were honestly impressed by your work, as in not kind, meaning that we were all sharpened. You know, we all were really keen for everyone to get good feedback that improves their work.
Which I love. I love that, because honesty is so important to a creative. You really do want to
and
hear the truth.
We appreciate that you've got this passion, because I think you've got a really fabulous story that's
going to get
out there. There is something magic, I think you'll agree, about speaking out your story, because
there
you can
is.
Hear the sentence structure, you can hear the impact, you can sort of see whether, you know, description is working or not. I'd actually like to ask you to read some of your beautiful story.
I'd love to.
Roll it out.
Oh, thank you, Maria. This chapter is called Encounter. Hey, boy. Jay recognised the man sitting on the bench from that day at St. Raphael's last year. The nuns had flapped around him like excited magpies, as if he were the Pope himself. Beside the man, a child licked a red ice block, his cheeks so fat that they squashed his eyes almost shut. Jay was reminded of a pumpkin as he looked at the bright orange T-shirt which curled above the kid's distended tummy. Finished work for the day, have you, boy? The man examined the footpath in great detail, as if trying to find a crack in it. Boy, parroted the child. A smouldering cigarette landed beside Jay's left shoe, making him jump backwards. What say we have a talk? Come on, little Stevie. The man rose as he grabbed the child's hand and lifted him onto the footpath, tiny sandals making a slapping sound. The man's stomach was even fatter than the child's. It hung over the top of trousers, which he hitched up by the waistband every couple of steps. His breathing sounded like a machine whose batteries were running low. We can sit in the beer garden. Jay didn't want to go to the beer garden, but you didn't say no to the man with red hair. He remained a few steps behind the man and child and watched as they waddled the short distance to the Royal Hotel. You go with the boy, little Stevie. The man addressed the child in the sort of voice Jay suspected rich, white people save for their children. The kind of voice that asked, would you like another lolly, or what would you like for Christmas? The little kid offered up a pudgy hand to Jay, who reluctantly took hold of it. A shiver of revulsion moved through him at the sight of what resembled two transparent slugs winding their way from the kid's nose and wrapping around his mouth. Wait in the beer garden, the man commanded. Everything the man said to him sounded angry, as if he, Jay, had done something wrong and was going to pay for it. A growl of male voices rose as the man disappeared through the stained glass doors into the pub. What if someone were to pop up out of nowhere and ask why he was standing there holding a little white kid's hand? He'd never been in the beer garden before, and searched for evidence of flowers, or at least greenery, but there was just a concrete slab. An elderly couple were the only other people around. They watched him and the boy silently, sipping on shandies, and, other than the movement of arm to mouth, they were as stiff as corpses. A defeated-looking red and white awning hung limply over a metal table beside the back door to the main bar. As he lifted him onto a white plastic chair, the scant remains of Stevie's ice block plopped onto the table. The long, thin blade of a scream travelled through Jay's ear, and he imagined his brain vibrating. Mouth wide open, the angry pink of the child's throat was visible. A bubble of snot the size and shape of a grape kept inflating and disappearing, only to reappear. Here we go, the man said, as he plonked a tin tray with a beer and a lemon squash on the table. Jay's heart thumped. What if the man accused him of making the child cry? Squash, Stevie, the man said as he placed the drink in front of the child, who stopped crying straight away and stuck both hands into the glass. Bottoms up, the man said, as he raised the schooner to his mouth and sat down. He drank half of the contents in one gulp before he belched loudly. There was no drink for Jay. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw that the man had wrapped his body around the schooner of beer. He stared into the amber liquid the way Uncle Willie did sometimes, as if it held some secret to be uncovered. You know little Stevie here loves nursery stories, the man said into his beer. Jay felt his skin prickle and he sat back in the chair as far from the man as possible. I read to him every night, from those little golden books. Do you know them? Takes me back, it does, all those stories. The man removed a packet of Camels from his pocket and a box of matches and went about lighting up. My old man used to teach me proverbs. Try and educate me in the ways of the world, as it were. Do you know what my favourite proverb is? Curiosity killed the cat. The man raised his eyes to stare at Jay. There was nowhere to look other than at the man or the child or the old people over in the corner. The kid was now standing on the chair, his tongue lapping at the drink as if he were a small orange dog. I hear you were out at the river when the cops fished out that kid. Jay kept staring at the child rather than meet the man's eyes. When I hear about a fella turning up to where a troublemaking little bastard is drowned, I wonder to myself, what was that fella doing there? Jay tried not to think of the shape of Arthur's body beneath the sheet that day. The thing is, a boy like that kid that drowned, he was the type that liked to walk around and, let's say, observe the goings on around town. A boy like that might just come across something that has nothing to do with him. You know what I'm saying? The man blew smoke into Jay's face, which made his eyes water. It's no sure thing that a boy like that kept things to himself. Jay watched as the man ground the remains of his cigarette into an ashtray, with fingers stained the colour of twisties. If you don't want to end up like your sneaky little mate, you need to keep your mouth shut. Consider yourself lucky you're getting off with a warning. I've asked around about you, and it seems everyone agrees you're a wishy-washy kind of kid. Suppose it's because you're neither one thing nor the other, are you, boy? Just about as close to nothing as a person could be. Jay's body leapt from the chair, and he ran the few steps it took to reach the handle of the door to the pub, entered the heavy atmosphere. You aren't allowed in here. A woman behind the bar with a slash of red for a mouth yelled at him. The room crawled with menace. It scratched, gnawed, and burrowed deep inside him as he made for the exit. It followed him out into Main Street and past St. Raphael's and Our Lady of the Sacred Heart Church. His feet pounded the rhythm of those words. They were on fire, his feet, squishing around inside old school shoes where tiny pebbles cruelly found their way. Traffic on the highway was so close that he felt the air swoosh around him. As a road train passed, he briefly glimpsed the long, sad faces of sheep squeezed through the rails. What did they ever do to anyone? Through eyes blurred as if underwater, he saw the sign telling him how far he had to go. The man's parting words at the pub rang in his ears. You're nothing.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Maria.
And what can you say? That was just stunning. And now on to the critique part of our program. Sajid.
Hi, Maria.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we've both just listened to Teresa's interview and story.
Fantastic it was.
But you also are working on a memoir.
Yes, I am. It's sort of work in progress.
And your day job?
I've got a degree and I've studied really hard in my life and I've had a career, a very, very strong career in human resources and work health and safety.
Oh, okay. So you would be able to relate, Therese, who's also had a corporate background.
100%. When I was listening, I was thinking it's so different to writing.
Yeah. You look after kids?
Yes, I look after them a little bit too much. Still folding the undies.
When I was hearing your story, also in a country town, and you were also talking about quite similar issues.
Very similar in the sense that there's not a transparent racism, transparent bigoting, or transparent conversations.
Mm.
And I think Therese said that she was listening constantly to what was happening. And I think very similar to what I've written in my memoir, no one ever said anything, but when you sat and listened to conversations, you could pick up the actual meaning of those conversations and read the nonverbal cues more than the verbal cues.
I know right at the end, you know, the guy actually said, you know, you're worth nothing. But in fact, everything that led up to that statement.
And also, I think with looking and not saying.
looking, and it's the looks.
Yes, for a young child, I'm assuming that Jay is about 8, 9 years old.
Yes, that's right.
So that's what I picked up.
Yeah.
And I think when you're younger, you don't, I suppose, attach meanings of nonverbal cues, but about 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you start comparing and attaching.
Yeah.
So that was really well done in Teresa's.
Wasn't it? And then there are the sharp edges of everything that's happening around you.
Yes.
And it sinks deep.
It does. I could just relate to everything and can smell and hear and feel all the senses come into play.
Mm.
Exactly how she described. So you're that child in Jay's body back there, which was just amazing for me to listen to that.
Yeah. Yours was a more coastal town and it had a very different cultural mix. Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe what that mix is?
Sure. It's a beautiful seaside village. You had the old Australians that moved there to set up the town, probably, you know, generationally 100 years before. But over the years, that demographics changed drastically. The people that were moving in were the unfortunates in a lot of ways.
Unfortunates.
And then the new immigrants. So the new immigrants were the Indians. So we're all Sikhs.
Mm-hmm.
They're from Punjab in India.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd actually like to talk about those elements of her craft, because of all the writers that I dealt with, she was probably the most methodical. She did appraises of each chapter and did a little what was going to happen when the out crafted the whole thing out, and yet her process is so creative. It seems to well up.
I think Therese probably has a similar, where she's gone back in time,
remembered
and explored those core memories, but then she had to put it into a story.
Yes.
So I think that's quite difficult.
What did you like about it?
The descriptions.
Yeah, so visual.
Like, absolutely. And she's touched all the senses. Like, I really felt I just wanted to continue to listen because I could feel, I could hear, I could smell everything that she was actually describing without describing.
Yes.
She did it in a way that was very subtle, I think.
It was like this example I wrote down where she was saying a slash of red for a mouth. So she didn't say...
I just wrote that down as well. That was just incredible.
And it sort of seemed to pour out of her pen.
Yes.
There are no similes, there are no adjectives. Mm. Suddenly it's there in front of you. You know what this woman looks like.
That's right, yeah.
It's almost like she's got little hooks on each of those words and they draw up these sensations and memories. It's peculiar for me how sensitized she is.
I think living in the corporate world is that you continue to behave in a stereotype yourself. So a lot of those memories are just there.
Oh, I see. So are you saying that having lived in this highly structured corporate type of world, you create a shell.
And an image.
And an image, and you live inside it, but in fact it gives you a lot of freedom. So that stuff is almost preserved in Bell
Jar. It's like a play acting. So when you look on, so I think Therese has started to explore her background because it's been hidden so well in a pretend world.
I think any type of writing, it's almost like doing surgery on yourself.
Mm.
And it becomes harder and harder to keep that shell, any shell.
And you don't want to. I think it's that freedom that you get. Let's remove these cloaks and show yourself.
When she's writing this, it's not a memoir, it's a story, it's a novel. She's trawling back through her own memories and experiences of having been in this small town, which she doesn't want to name. And she was...
I can understand that.
Yes. You didn't name yours either. I was kind of surprised, but there you go. The character that came through is somebody she's never met and was part of her family. So the story that she gave, which, her mother...
The brother.
That mother had a brother that she didn't know anything about and...
So is that Jay?
That's Jay.
Okay.
As a writer, you know you can't write that truly unless the character is talking to you.
Mm-hmm. But I'm surprised that Jay's not her. Because she's picked up...
So much.
So much.
Like, so you feel it is her.
I thought it was her. But she could see that in the child's eyes.
Yeah.
And from a child's perspective. So how could she see all that?
She did grow up where this issue of Indigenous and white community were face-to-face all the time.
Similar to me.
Similar to you. And this is why when I heard you were talking about all the divisions there were.
And I think it was a hierarchy. So you had like unspoken rules, like I said, but the people that were not, say, Indian or not the old white families or the new white families or the white families that, you know, weren't wealthy, the people that didn't belong to those distinct groups were the nobodies. And the nobodies were normally the ones that had crossed boundaries. So if you had white Australian getting pregnant before she got married, she belonged nowhere.
Yeah.
But if you had an Indian marrying an Australian, they belong nowhere. Or an Indigenous crossing the boundaries and marrying into white, or white marrying into Indigenous, they belong nowhere.
Yeah.
So these were the unspoken rules of society. So when I look at Jay, the child, through what I could relate to with these people that didn't belong in a community, because that was a belonging, I think, is a big thing in the child's eyes and from a child's perspective.
Yeah, I agree.
Children want to belong somewhere.
Of course they do. Or as one of my friends would say, all writers are outcasts because you're suddenly in another world.
You're right. Like, I think you begin writing because you're something that you're passionate about. I don't know where Teresa's passions come in from, but she's got a lot of passion.
Oh my gosh. This is the interesting thing in terms of, you know, political protocol or I don't know what you would call it, just even literary protocol. Getting in the skin of somebody else's culture is pretty much of a no-go zone. If I was being written about as sensitively and beautifully as that, it is then crossing into that other territory of the power of a writer to be drawn by a character that they have no choice over. Someone who is part of your family has got a common ancestor.
Sure.
They've got a common ancestor.
Yes, yes.
And one of the other key characters is an auntie who
is Indigenous or non-Indigenous?
Non-Indigenous.
Okay.
There are several characters.
So she's actually, Teresa's looked at it from different viewpoints.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. That she's looked at a bigger situation.
Yeah.
That's really, really good. She's even done a better job than I thought. So that's like an art in itself.
People who can talk about country Australia from that lived experience and not from that, you know, typical stereotyping.
You can only live it, and because the language, because she said, curiosity killed the cat.
Yes. You know, she's taken a capsule of time and she's captured it so beautifully.
Beautifully, yes.
Yes.
And it's good to get critiqued by another that's going through that stage as well.
By people who are readers. Like, these are the people you want to reach 100%, as a reader. I mean, it's all very well to get a literary critique, but really they're not going to buy your book. They're going to get given a book. I think what you and Therese have in common is that you're both avid readers. That creates a platform for knowing what works.
Without unconsciously, I
think. Yeah. What did you think about her statements, finding her tribe?
I think it's that belonging. Even joining the writers group, that in itself is belonging, because that's something in me that's nurtured.
Yeah.
That my other people that I socialise or work or whatever with don't understand.
Yes. Isn't it interesting that Teresa's book is about not belonging and belonging to the tribe.
That's beautiful the way she's described it and the wording that she's used as well. So that itself creates an image for the reader.
Yeah. Look, thank you very much.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you.
This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support and inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I look forward to your company next time.